general idea of what why people convert to Christianity, in this case, a kind of typology of conversion. And we must start our discussion of conversion today by the last of that. That is to say, people who converted under the impetus of Romanticism and the Enlightenment, who converted not for utilitarian reasons, that is economic or status reasons, who converted not because they had a vision, but who converted because of Romanticism and the Enlightenment, as I said last time, a kind of cultural conversion. Here, the interesting case study is the family of Moses Mendelssohn, which both penetrated to the heart of Romanticism and to the heart of the Romantic establishment, and whose conversion is important from our point of view. Last time I quoted the theologian Schleiermacher, the Romantic theologian, and Schleiermacher's wife was Dorothea Mendelssohn, Moses Mendelssohn's daughter, who first married Schlegel, the famous Romantic philosopher. Then Schleiermacher converted to Protestantism, and in the end, as so many, went all the way to the Catholic Church. This is a phenomena of Jewish conversions on which I do not want to dwell at length, that eventually Catholicism is for Jews the most attractive. The reason is, I think, rather simple. Theology as a liturgy, Catholicism as a liturgy, Catholicism has a very definite theology. It is a more definite thing to convert to, by and large, than especially this Romantic Protestantism. All of Mendelssohn's descendants converted, children and grandchildren. Abraham Mendelssohn, his son, baptized all his four children, including, of course, the composer, Felix Mendelssohn. And in this, typically enough, he followed the advice of his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law, who came from the wealthiest, most prestigious family of Berlin court Jews. That is to say, who had been court Jews and who became wealthy bankers, the family of Itzig. It was his brother-in-law who advised him to do that, and he followed his brother-in-law's advice. Moreover, typically enough, his brother-in-law gave him another advice. His brother-in-law changed his name from Itzig, which granted isn't exactly a thing of beauty, to the name of his estate, to the name of his Prussian estate. The Prussian estate's name was Bartholdy. And indeed, Mendelssohn's adopted, after their baptism, the name of this Prussian estate, and from then to this day, still one of the wealthiest banking families, will be known as Mendelssohn Bartholdy. Why? Because, as Abraham Mendelssohn wrote, they adopted the new name of Bartholdy not to force upon the children a life of martyrdom. The father of Karl Marx, Heinrich Marx, argued in the same way. But what is interesting here, before we come to Heinrich Marx, is that Abraham believed that he was fulfilling the wishes of his father, that what he was doing through the baptizing, through the adoption of the other name, was a tribute to the laws of the Enlightenment. He now believed in Dohm's sense, that you have to choose. The ceremonial law has dropped away, and the father of Karl Marx, Heinrich Marx, same generation, shared this. You now have to choose. Heinrich Marx, like Abraham Mendelssohn, was still holding of the Enlightenment, even in the 1830s, the young Karl Marx was brought up reading Rousseau above all. So you can see again here the idea. There is no sense in a life of martyrdom if there is nothing behind that martyrdom, if you have no reason for that martyrdom. Now it is clear that women like Dorothea and the other famous woman, the wife of the banker Hertz, Henrietta Hertz, who most of you know, of course, in another connection, Henrietta Hertz had the famous romantic salon in Berlin. Every romantic philosopher was a guest in the salon of Henrietta Hertz. She was right in the center of things, the wife of another wealthy banker. She also converted after her husband's death. She also converted. Again, people, Dorothea and Henrietta Hertz, were at the center of intellectual life. And therefore it makes sense for them to convert, for they were at the center of Romanticism. And Romanticism and a romantic Christianity went together, an integral part of this culture. Moreover, the price of entry was very easy, for you could do two things, as they did. You could use the Enlightenment at a price of entry, the rationalism, as Abraham Mendelssohn did, and with it you could combine romantic religion, which had very little theology, in which you had to believe, which stressed the romanticism rather than the theology. The universal God remained, but the abstract ethic could be combined with romantic religion, and both with a repudiation of Judaism. The kind of balance, which, as I told you before, the Jewish reform movement had tried to maintain, was now abolished. Listen now to what Abraham Mendelssohn writes to his son. Writes to his brother-in-law, Itzig. I'm sorry, I went wrong again. Which means what his brother-in-law wrote to Abraham Mendelssohn. Come to him then. What his brother-in-law wrote to Abraham Mendelssohn to persuade him to take these steps, to persuade him above all to adopt the name Bartholdi. When you say you owe it to the memory of your father, that is to keep being a Jew, you owe this to a memory of your father, Moses Mendelssohn. But do you think you have done something bad in giving your children the religion which appears to you to be best? It is the justest homage you or any of us could pay to the efforts of your father to promote true life and knowledge, and he would have acted like you for his children. You may remain faithful to an oppressed, persecuted religion. You may leave it to your children as a prospect of lifelong martyrdom, as long as you believe it to be the absolute truth. But when you have ceased to believe that, it is barbarism. I advise you to adopt the name Mendelssohn Bartholdi as a distinction from the other Mendelssohn. At the same time, you would please me very much, because it would be a means of preserving the memory of the estate long in my family. Thus you would gain your point without doing anything unusual, for in France and elsewhere it is the custom of adding a name like that, which is actually true. Now you can see the argument. It is plain, it is simple, and I think we must say, from the point of view of the culture of the Enlightenment and Romanticism, it is convincing. Why a life of martyrdom for your children if you no longer believe what you are martyred for is the truth? For the universal God is the God of all of us. And moreover, Christianity is the true expression of culture, of a Romanticism. That is the argument. then does it come down to? It comes down to a letter from Abraham Mendelssohn, which I read to you before in another connection. Does God exist? What is God? He is a part of ourselves, and where and how? All this I do not know, but I know that there exists in me and you and in all human beings an everlasting inclination towards all that is good, true, and right, and a conscience which warns us when we go astray. For Abraham Mendelssohn, Judaism also was an ethical idea, but it was an ethical idea now detached from Jewish ethical monotheism. The universalism of the Enlightenment was now generalized. The outward form of religion your teacher has given you is historical and changeable, like all human ordinances. 1,000 years ago, the Jewish form was the reigning one, then the heathen form, and now it is Christian. In other words, the historical argument, so important in the science of Judaism, as I told you last time, enters again. We have educated you and your brothers and sisters in the Christian faith, because it is the creed of most civilized people and contains nothing that can lead you away from what is good and much that guides you to love, obedience, tolerance, even if it was nothing but the example of its founder, understood by few and followed by a still fewer. The dilemma is clear. If Judaism as a religion no longer has meaning, what then has meaning? Why then the martyrdom? Why not join the civilized people? That means in terms of the times the people most oppressed of all culture. This remains. I point out to you in your Zionist idea, point page 128, Moses Hess makes the same argument, and he solves it by going to Jewish nationalism, as yet in our period unknown. For what does Moses Hess say, even in 1862, a man who comes from that tradition, on page 128, you can read it, of your Zionist idea, from the viewpoint of the Enlightenment, I see no tenable reason for the continued existence of either Judaism or Christianity. The Jew who does not believe in the national regeneration of his people has only one task, to labor like the enlightened Christian for the dissolution of his religion. I understand how one can hold such an opinion, but what I do not understand is how it is possible to believe simultaneously in the Enlightenment and in the mission of the Jews. In other words, how it is possible to believe at once in the ultimate dissolution and the continued existence of Judaism. What you will read then in page 128 is a critique of Jewish reform, of the halfway house for these people. But the final expression of this kind of idea goes much further. It goes into our time. It is best expressed and summarized in the 1920s, that late, by the most important Jewish theologian, anti-Zionist theologian, and the most important one, about whom you will hear much more later, Franz Rosenzweig. And Franz Rosenzweig has a letter to a friend which summarizes. He had a friend called Hans in here who tried to get some relation to Judaism, so much of this generation no longer had, and went to a rabbi, a Jewish theologian, and this is Rosenzweig's criticism, and it is the same thing that I'm talking about. 1909 is the date. About Hans, we simply don't see eye to eye. What you say about the three visits to a Jewish theologian won't hold water. Not even 300 visits would have changed matters. We are Christians in everything. We live in a Christian state, attend Christian schools, read Christian books. In short, our whole culture rests entirely on a Christian foundation. Consequently, a man who has nothing holding him back needs only a very slight push to make him accept Christianity. In Germany today, reform is talking about, the Jewish religion cannot be accepted. It has to be grafted on by circumstances, dietary observance, and bar mitzvah. That could be said for American Jews as well. Dietary observance and bar mitzvah. Christianity has a tremendous advantage over Judaism. It would have been entirely out of the question for Hans to become a Jew. A Christian, however, he can become. To let you know how serious I am about this, I myself counseled Hans strongly in this direction, that is conversion, and would do so again. This letter of Franz Rosenzweig, which if you want to read, you can find in Nahum Glaser's Franz Rosenzweig, a pocketbook, on page 19. This letter is, again, the same kind of thing. That in other words, if everything is Christian, and again, as Abraham Mendelssohn put it, the most civilized people, why then remain a Jew? Reform Judaism here is, again, no solution. No solution. And this criticism comes from a Jewish theologian who will renew Jewish theology in many ways, and you will see. Now, I think I have said enough to make it clear that the Enlightenment Jewish atmosphere led to this Christian romanticism. Such conversions were frequent, as the Mendelssohn family. We must call them genuine conversions. They accepted the progress of the Spirit. They sought to transcend Judaism, but without any Jewish self-hate. That must be clear. Moreover, without any utilitarian ideas, the Mendelssohns and the Itzigs were wealthy, wealthy people. They gained nothing by this. In status and in commerce, nothing whatever. The utilitarian element here is non-existent. You can, of course, have a mixture of this Enlightenment romanticism and quest for status. Heinrich Marx, the father of Karl Marx, is such a problem. He baptized his children and converted himself largely out of the same impetus to be abreast of the Enlightenment, to be abreast in certain ways of Romanticism as well. But in Heinrich Marx there is an extra thing. By the new legislation of Prussian emancipation, he could not be a state official, that is, not a lawyer. The Rhineland had just come to Prussia. Prussian edicts were now enforced in the Rhineland. Thus, Heinrich Marx, if he stayed a Jew, would have to give up his legal profession. Because remember, that was one of the terms of Prussian emancipation. By his baptism, he remained to stay a lawyer. There is about this very famous baptism that, first of all, the Enlightenment, in his letter to his son Karl, eventually, talking about his baptism, he reaffirms his belief in God, but he adds it is the God of Newton and John Locke. No doubt that played a part in his baptism, but the status too, to remain a lawyer. But the baptism of his children is a puzzle, because Karl Marx was not baptized until he was to enter school. We do not know why this is. The only guess is that he entered the Protestant school, which was the best school in the city of Trier. And to enter the Protestant school, it was easier if you were baptized. It is probably that Karl Marx was eventually baptized, but baptized in such later time probably has to do with his entering school and the school he wanted to enter.
But it's very costly, because Karl Marx was baptized very late in the day. The other children were baptized earlier, and so was the father. But as I say, we really do not know why this is. Now, if this is one and the most important type of conversion, we must now add to it the conversion that was a true Christian commitment in the traditional sense, the conversion that begins with a vision. The most famous case in our period is the case of Serf Burr, brothers, after their baptism took the name of Ratisbon. The more important of these two brothers, Serf Burr, Theodore, became converted in 1842 by a vision of the Virgin Mary during a visit to Rome. He joined the Jesuits, and in 1856 did something rather famous. He founded a new religious order, the Order of Our Lady of Zion. The Order of Our Lady of Zion, in 1856, was a religious order founded to convert Jews. This, by the way, remained its function until recently, when Pope John the 23rd transformed it to an order of dialogue with Jews, from conversion with Jews. But the Order of Our Lady of Zion became a very powerful and spreading one. Those of you who have been to Jerusalem know two things, because in 1855, Ratisbon departed for Palestine and lived out his life there. You know two things of its power and importance. You know the Ratisbon Monastery, and you know the Convent of Our Lady of Zion. If you have been in Jerusalem in Christmas and you have known me, that is where we go for Christmas Mass, in the old city. And I have good friends there. But Our Lady of Zion is powerful order, and you can see its remnants in Jerusalem today. Obviously, it has declined with the decline of Christianity, and even the members of the order in the old city now seem to be mostly in their 70s. The monastery in the new city, the famous Ratisbon Monastery, has become student housing. That is quite a change. I mean, for the Hebrew University. Best student housing there is if you go. Excellent, recommended. Now, there are still a few monks there to keep you aware of the religious ideal. That's also good. So what you have then here is a conversion by vision, which led to the founding of a new Catholic order to convert Jews, Our Lady of Zion. The third type of conversion is the one that you all think about, the conversion of cynicism. Here we can take Eduard Ganz, one of the founders of that circle of men of the Club for Jewish Culture and Learning. You may remember Eduard Ganz, who converted in order to get an academic appointment. This is how he describes his conversion. And notice how different it is from Abraham Mendelssohn's description of it and things of that nature. Eduard Ganz says the following: I might as well convert to get an academic post. For the minister, academic posts were appointed by the Prussian Minister of Culture and Education. For the Minister of Education realizes, I don't mean it. I know I don't mean it. And thus the state has been given its due. Now, this is what we might call similarly honest. But you might say a conversion for a job, a conversion for a state. Such conversions, of course, were frequent. And the state made it easy through religious indifference After all you had to do to convert is to find some clergyman who would do it. There isn't a long thing attached to it. You could find a clergyman who would do it in short order without many lessons. I mean, there is no circumcision or anything attached. It's a very easy affair, really. And the state furthered it. And the state furthered it. Because the state was, in a sense, on this, of course, extremely friendly. Extremely friendly. This was in the interest of the state. And so everything was made easy, no questions were asked, and indeed the cynicism of Edward Duns corresponds to the cynicism of the church, in a sense, and the cynicism of the state. You have therefore then three kinds of conversion. The conversion to culture, which is the most important from our point of view, because it is the most important intellectual who chose that road. By vision, that will continue, and the cynicism, that will continue. But I want to point out to you that the conversion by culture will also continue. That I want to point out to you as well. It will continue, perhaps in a slightly changed form. In a slightly changed form. It will continue not so much under the impetus of Romanticism and the Enlightenment, but it will continue in the same way under the impetus of radical democracy and socialism. It will be much the same idea of a universal God, much the same idea of transcendence, and if you can put it perhaps slightly differently, much the same conversion to philosophy. Much the same conversion to philosophy. Always encouraged by the dominance of Hegel and Hegelianism, by the dominance of historical and idealist philosophy, by the idea expressed in Mendelssohn's letter that Judaism is a fossil, and that Christianity is the next higher expression of a philosophy. So you have that kind of conversion continuing as well. In that case, we also have, in a way, a case study to which I want to come in this regard, and that case study is another famous man, the conversion to philosophy. We might put it, because a conversion to Christianity is then no longer needed. Romanticism has run its course. There is no need for a conversion to Christianity. You can now convert to pure philosophy. That is to say, to abstract ideas of a universal God and of the Enlightenment. The example I want to take here is the example of La Salle. La Salle, the founder, as you know, of German socialism. In case you haven't heard, Marx is not the founder of German social democracy. He's not even the most influential man, properly speaking. But La Salle is the founder of German social democracy and probably the most influential figure in its history, though he died very early. Let us take Ferdinand La Salle. An interesting example. For Ferdinand La Salle believed in the Enlightenment, in the autonomy of human self-consciousness. And so he first joined Reform. He attended Geiger's sermons and Geiger's synagogue. But that did not go far enough for him. And in the end, joining the circle around Karl Marx in 1843, a year before Marx did so, he wrote about the ugliness, the lack of beauty of Judaism. Here you again see a shadow of Romanticism still. The ugliness, the lack of beauty of Judaism. He wrote this to his Orthodox mother. The end of Judaism was to come. The end of Judaism must come, in fact. But it comes now through what? Not through the Enlightenment, but through Hegelian philosophy. Lassalle was an impassionate Hegelian. This was the most important influence in his life, as it was in Marx's life in the 1840s. And through Hegelian philosophy, Judaism must end, because the idea will triumph, and the idea surpasses Judaism and Christianity, though Christianity is even a higher stage. In the end, the Hegelian idea surpasses both Judaism and Christianity, and becomes for him, of course, the socialist idea. This is a course we will follow when I talk next week about Marx's pamphlet on the Jewish question of 1844. Now, in all these conversions, there is one contradiction and one outside pressure. The contradiction is plain. None of these people ever left Jewish social circles. The social discrimination was so strong that the Mendelssohn Bartholdys had only Jewish friends and were regarded as Jews by everyone else, really. And the same is true for Lassalle. And the same is true for Eduard Ganz. In other words, no longer did conversion mean integration. We shall see why next week. But now I must mention that the social barriers were so strong that, conversion or not, these converted Jews remained within the Jewish orbit, for their friends were Jews, for they were regarded as Jews, even into the fourth or fifth generation, regardless of their intermarriages. That is the first thing that you must notice. And the second thing you must notice is what I call the outside pressure. The outside pressures are two in number, really. One outside pressure is the pressure of the existing orthodoxy. For it existed on Germany's border, in Alsace and Lorraine. Therefore, the Western Jews always had the problem to distance themselves from the masses of unassimilated, strange dressing and strange praying Orthodox Eastern Jews. This was made still more difficult by a literature which was written by East European ghetto Jews who had fled from the ghetto and who hated every part of it. To give you a most famous title to which we shall return, Emil Franzose's Half Asia, the famous anti-Semitic term that the Jews are half Asia, was coined by a Jew who had fled the ghetto, who wrote a famous novel, which if it were translated, I would have had you read, called Half Asia, about the ghetto itself. But there were many others. The stereotype of the ghetto was a considerable outside pressure for Western Jews. A considerable outside pressure to assimilate. For the ghetto meant what it means, in fact, in Singer's Family Moscot. It meant dirt, poverty, all of these sort of things. It meant, in fact, half Asia. And as you will see in the Family Moscot, especially page 27 of your edition, German culture meant for the ghetto civilization. In other words, let us not misunderstand that. The young, sensitive Jews who wanted to escape the ghetto, they looked to the Western Jews. They looked to Germany. They looked to advanced culture. In other words, the advanced ghetto Jew and Abraham Mendelssohn agreed on what was civilization, on what was advanced culture. You mustn't forget. And so, when they fled to the West, or came to the West, Those who were articulate would write books condemning the culture which they had fled for civilized people, as they would put it. That is, for the Western culture, for the Enlightenment, for Romanticism. Then the ghetto civilization was half Asia. But there's also the concrete and the visual, which you must not forget, which was, to say the least, embarrassing to the West. Embarrassing. Namely, that the immigration from Eastern Europe retained its peculiar dress, that is to say, the kaftan hats, its peculiar appearance, by them very peculiar for Western Jews and others, the side locks, the payas, the beards, all of that, the yarmulkes, otherwise. This was an embarrassment. This was a rejection of culture as far as these people were concerned, quite obviously. A rejection of all of this kind of emancipation that I have talked about. But in turn, this was a pressure, and a very considerable pressure. Please remember that, for assimilation, and in the end, even for conversion. For it is quite true that by the 1830s, the Western Jews of this nature had more in common with their Gentile compatriots than they had with the Eastern European Jews. Therefore, it follows that the history of Western Judaism now is, as it has been, a flight from the ghetto. And this will be true for the Zionists as well. When you read Herzl, the part that you don't read, because this is edited, the Zionist idea, that's edited according to Zionist ideology, and it leaves out embarrassing things. I'll tell you one thing it leaves out right now from Herzl, which we should come back to, when Theodor Herzl writes eloquently about the Middle Ages in the midst of Europe, which is the reason for anti-Semitism. He means the East European ghetto and the East European Jews, happily cut out of your anthology. That's what Herzl means. That's what Herzl means. There you can see that even for a man like Herzl, especially perhaps for a man like Herzl at the center of European culture in one way or another, this Zionism for him was certainly largely at first and for no doubt almost totally the abolition of the ghetto, the rich embarrassment. After all, what is Herzl's vision in the end, also cut out of your reading? The final vision of Herzl is that Palestine is happily settled by Jews and Arabs living in harmony, and rich Jews coming and inspecting the place. Well, that's happened actually, hasn't it? But, you haven't lived there, you'll agree with me. It happened a slightly different way. But what you have here is, of course, again, the flight from the ghetto. The flight from the ghetto will characterize Western Jews and will characterize many ghetto Jews. And Herzl's phrase from the Middle Ages, in the midst of Europe, who in the Enlightenment way should be transformed to productive people again in Palestine, that sort of vision becomes a general vision. For example, one example of this rapidly, to make it clear to you again, the Jewish community of Königsberg in East Prussia wanted to help the poverty-stricken Jews of White Russia, which were right at their border, after all, and set up a committee. And the finding of the committee is as follows, in the 1860s, that before we can make them economically prosperous, we must raise their level of culture. They now have no culture. We must first raise their level of culture, and then perhaps we can make them economically prosperous. This was the official Jewish community of Königsberg in East Prussia. That was the attitude, a complete misreading of ghetto culture. That goes without saying, but misreading is is not true, a complete non-understanding of ghetto culture. Because since emancipation, you had Western Judaism veering away. For we must remember, and I mention it again before I come to it at length, that for Eastern European Jews, the development had been inverse. Where Western Jews were emancipated, Eastern Jews in the same time were put back into the ghetto. Remember the anti-Jewish legislation of 1804, which did all this in Eastern Europe, while in Western Europe, this is the age of emancipation. That is to say, these two branches of Judaism grew apart because the places in which they lived underwent quite different developments. Emancipation in the West, ghettoization and urbanization, forced ghettoization and forced urbanization in Eastern Europe. That we must not, after all, forget. Now, one outside pressure was the ghetto and all that that meant. Again, it is perhaps for you, in a more tolerant age, difficult to understand. But I remember still the shock I had as a boy when I was shown out of our chauffeur-driven limousine, the Eastern Jews peddling with the street through which the chauffeur should not have been driven, and he was bawled out afterwards, because I was not supposed to see that sort of thing, because it would lead to anti-Semitism. And on the chauffeur's part, no doubt, as well. However that was, I still remember the shock. These were creatures, of course, from another planet. Well, these Jews, these weren't Jews in the Reformed temple who drove up in the German equivalent of Cadillac, Maybachs, they were called. In the Maybachs, so that you needed three traffic policemen on the high holidays of the desert. You needed three Sabbath policemen, eventually of course 100 to prevent attacks by anti-Semites. But first you needed at least three, even in my youth, to direct the traffic on the high holidays. These weren't that kind of Jews. They were ununderstandable. They were different creatures. If Hitler reacted to East European Jews, as he says in Mein Kampf, and got a fright, because he saw what he had never seen in Linz, but all he had saw there were assimilated Jews in kaftans and earlocks and strange faces. This can be generalized, I think, to most of Western Judaism. This was strange and ununderstandable. And the enthusiasm for East European Jews, when it comes among Zionists, and it comes late, has even a word to it. Ostjuden enthusiasm. The enthusiasm for East European Jews. So strange that in Germany it even got a phrase. Because the Zionists suddenly discovered them, and that was a great discovery in the West. So, that had to come until the 1890s. So all of this was one pressure which you must remember. What was the other pressure? The other pressure was the great thing that we have omitted up to now. The other pressure was anti-Semitism and the nature of anti-Semitism. What I have done up to now, and some of you have said I've gone too fast, so I tried to slow down, quite understandable, is to deal with the internal history, if you like, with the history of Jews as a community. But in dealing with the history of Jews as a community, I have always tried to deal with it in general terms. And for some of you, it might be well to look at the textbook of European history. Because Jewish history is just a part of European history. It's nothing special. It's just a part of European history. That is all. And therefore you have to know European history. And if you don't, look at a textbook, please. But, as it is a part of European history,
European history incurred at every angle. It made emancipation possible, but it also made, together with emancipation, not only a resurgence of anti-Semitism, that always had existed, but a new type of anti-Semitism, and that had not always existed. A new type of anti-Semitism, which is quite different from the old, a new type. We must therefore now, starting next week, pass to the second segment of your assignment sheet, the segment anti-Semitism. And what we must see is the birth of the new anti-Semitism and the decline, or at least not the growing, of the old anti-Semitism. That is really what we must see next week. But what I will do on Monday is I will first of all ask you if you have any questions, as we cannot have a discussion this Friday. I'll ask you on Monday.